My name's Eric Wishart. I'd like to welcome you to this lunch and introduce you to our guest, Carl Darrell Gunfeld, who's came all the way from Pacific Palisades, California, to be in Hong Kong. And very interesting subject, I think, the transition journalists face going from the news business to writing fiction, non-fiction. I mean, Carl is quite a remarkable writer. He can do everything from what I can see. He can write for Time magazine. He can write non-fiction books about the SARS outbreak in Hong Kong. He's written very powerful book about his relationship with his autistic brother. And he comes from a background of writers, because his mother, I think, was Japanese, and your father's American, and they were writers as well. They wrote books about living with the difficulties of having an autistic child in the 60s, when there was so much ignorance about it at the time. But Carrie tells me he's working another fiction novel, right? Fiction. Your latest book is fiction.
This is fiction.
Right. This is fiction, right. And I mean, this is just something that faces journalists. How do you make this transition from journalism to writing novels? Sometimes it's absolutely almost the opposite of everything you've ever learned to do. I mean, particularly now as a news agency journalist, the thing is shrinking. It's become Twitter and news tickers, so it's completely the opposite of trying to write a substantial book. But Carl's going to talk today about the challenge facing journalists becoming novelists in the internet age. So just before I hand over the microphone to you, Carl, I'd just like to say that we've got another club lunch next week, Inside the Chinese Judiciary, How It Really Works, which should be interesting. Professor Mike McConville's doing that, an insight into the judicial legal system across the border. And that's next Monday. So without any further ado, Carl, can I...
Hi there. And I don't know where they got the topic for today. I'm not sure. It's the note I sent in, but anyway, I mean, I can approximate what I want to say to the topic, I think. And one of when they sort of get in touch with you and ask you to do this, which was very gracious of Hilda and the FCC to ask me. You try to think of something that might be applicable to journalists or people who think about journalism and all that. And one of the things I thought about, and the reason I came up with this concept, which is sort of why at some point in my career did I decide, okay, I have to start writing fiction. And obviously there's storytelling and so forth. There's reasons like that. But then I realized there's a deeper reason, and that deeper reason is something that I haven't heard many people talk about, and that I think is worthy of discussion. And I'll go back to the very beginning, which is this idea that like many of us, I think, when I was in high school and college, I wanted to become a writer, and I dreamed of becoming a writer, and I always thought that was the profession for me. There isn't sort of one way to go about doing that. And I think that when I got out of college, I moved to Japan, and I was fortunate in that I got a job at an English language newspaper, the Asahi Evening News. It was an afternoon newspaper when those still existed, and so I began to sort of try to make something of myself as a writer, and pretty quickly I began to do magazine articles for sort of these publications in Japan, mostly, and then mostly a lot of in-flight magazines like Cathay Pacific, Discovery, Winds, Morning Calm, we called that the Clam. Air New Zealand had a magazine. ANA's magazine was Wingspan. So I was doing all stories for all these sort of in-flight magazines, and that was a great sort of business. You could kind of make a little money and do all this stuff. And then... But that whole time I was sort of kind of dreaming, like, what I really want to do is write for, you know, like, big American magazines. You know, that was the thing I really want to do, because that's sort of what I'd grown up reading and thinking about. And so I used to go up to, like, the Aoyama Book Center in Tokyo, near Roppongi, and sort of look at the magazines, And back then, it was like a rack as long as this wall of just fashion titles and men's titles and literary journals from all over the world. And they were just all there. And I would look at that, and it would be sort of the expression of like my heart's desire of what I wanted to do with my life. And I remember one time I was in this office working on this English language magazine in Tokyo, Tokyo Journal, and I remember a writer from Esquire turned up. It was a woman who came from Esquire to do some story about Tokyo. This was sort of during the bubble over there. And it seemed to me like she was doing the most glamorous thing in the world. You know, she was like sent from America to write like a big magazine article about Japan. And then that was sort of what my ambition was. And then I was kind of fortunate enough to actually begin to kind of write stories about Japan for these American magazines. I kind of got some breaks, and I was writing for Vogue and Details and all these magazines. But the funny thing about what I was doing and how I was doing it was I never really had any kind of training as a journalist. No one had ever kind of explained to me, well, you know, this is how it works, and you're supposed to do this, or, you know, you can't do this, and you can't, you know, you have to be, these are the rules, you know, and when you start writing for a magazine, no one kind of tells you, like, here are the rules, here's what we're going to do, right? And so I was sort of doing these stories, and I would just kind of, and I actually remember, I was, like, asking my dad, like, okay, I'm going to do this story about, you know, Japanese motorcycle gangs, and I would ask him this, and he's like, oh, just put all that stuff together into one scene, and, you know, get rid of this guy or take these quotes and kind of give them to this other guy, because it doesn't make sense to have these two different guys saying roughly the same thing all the time and just call all that one guy, right? So I was sort of, very early on, I was taking these kind of small liberties in my storytelling, right? And kind of doing this in the interest, you know, I thought, well, the basic emotional truth of the stories that I was writing was still there. And keep in mind that I never in my life sort of wrote stories that were, I was never a daily journalist, never a wire service, but I never really was like doing, you know, matters of watchdogging governments or uncovering corruption or trying to tell the story of an oppressed minority or anything that was really particularly of any great importance in the world. I was just trying to write like entertaining stories and kind of talk about cool stuff. And so I sort of began writing these magazine articles, and they were sort of these great yarns, wonderful stories, right? Mostly true, not entirely true, right? I wasn't cooking the facts, but I was simmering them a little bit, right? And this was kind of sort of felt normal, because the weird thing that was happening is while I was doing this, there were editors in New York on some of these stories who were also adding stuff to my stories that didn't seem to be based on any reality, right? So sort of everybody is in collusion on this thing about on these stories that are still being published as journalism or nonfiction or memoir or whatever you want to call it. These things are all being published, and it's going pretty well, right? I keep getting stories and people seem to like them, and you know, and no one's telling me, hey, you can't do this or you should do that or whatever, and you know, I'm 25 years old and or 24, 25, and you know, this is all great. And it sort of, you know, maybe once in a while it occurs to me, you know, well, what are the limits here? You know, how far can you go? Like, can you, you know, you can run quotes together or can't you? You can, you know, there's always this like disclaimer in my story, like composite characters were created or names and identifying characteristics have been changed, you know, and that was pretty common in magazines sort of in the 80s and 90s to have that kind of disclaimer. And if you go back further to like the 70s and we were talking before, I mean, it was really pretty loosey-goosey. I mean, Saturday Night Fever was published in, you know, New York Magazine, and it turned out the entire thing was made up. I mean, none of it existed, you know, and I don't remember if it was a scandal or if it was, the whole thing was so successful that nobody really cared. But the point was that I was sort of doing this stuff and you know, writing, you know, sort of these big, great narrative arc magazine articles and having a great time doing it and thinking like, you know, this is what sort of journalism is, right? And then like a couple things happened. One, I began to sort of I got a job at Time Magazine, right? And so I'm a smart guy, right? And I recognize, like, the standards for the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal, and the standards for, like, Details, and the standards for Cosmopolitan, they're different. They're all on this scale. And nobody kind of tells you, well, here's the standards here, and here's what you can do here, and at this publication you can, you know, you can put quotes together, but at this one you have to separate the quotes by ellipses if they're not said in the same conversation, and at this one, you know, you can't even use ellipses, you have to indicate, you know, and there's all these different rules, and no one sort of sits you down and tells you, like, here's how it works here, here's how it works there. But and when I got to Time, and I was hired at Time because of those stories that, you know, you can sort of question the verisimilitude of every aspect of those stories, but those stories sort of, you know, got me hired at this magazine. But I pretty quickly figured out I can't keep doing, you know, what I was doing, or you know, it just doesn't seem to fly here, you know. And this also coincided with the emergence of the internet as this, like, as I initially saw it, like this, you know, this amazing information source, but also this gigantic, like, fact-checking source. You know, suddenly everything I wrote was going to be, you know, it had to be more accurate because it's all going to be under scrutiny by everyone in the world. Like, I believe, like, most of the stories I wrote early in my career, the people I wrote about never even saw the stories. I mean, they weren't translated into Japanese, and, I mean, it was sort of like, it was, you know, like, nobody was keeping track of any of this. Suddenly I realized, like, everything I do is going to be carefully scrutinized, so I have to sort of be much more careful and adhere to, like, you know, whatever these standards are, you know, which is more of what we consider to be sort of traditional journalism. At the same time, a funny thing happens, which is as you kind of rise up a little bit as a writer, you begin to sort of start doing kind of more boring stories. You start getting assigned profiles of, like, politicians or profiles of athletes or profiles of actors, whatever, and these stories don't lend themselves, even if one were to decide, okay, I'm going to, you know, use my creative powers to turn this into a, you know, a magnificent narrative. It just, you know, sort of 2 hours spent, you know, two hours spent, like, with a publicist and an actor just don't lend it to that kind of story. So I naturally became a little bit more cautious or circumspect in terms of how I was telling stories and more careful. Now, what happened, though, was I think my stories became, like, a little more boring gradually over the years. And I think as a writer, I was sort of like, I was writing more, I was publishing a hell of a lot more, but sort of none of the, I sort of wasn't able to kind of get the sort of creative juice out of stories that I'd been able to before. And this probably went on for a number of years where I kind of was just writing, you know, most of my years at Time Magazine, I was writing really pretty boring stuff that the magazine seemed to like and everyone seemed to like it, but it wasn't very sort of emotionally satisfying for me, for what I wanted to do. And at the same time, I mean, I'm always paying attention here, all these writers start getting in trouble because they're accused of making stuff up, right? I mean, with different degrees of legitimacy. Stephen Glass is, like, you know, that New Republic guy was clearly way off the reservation in terms of what he was doing. But then, like, memoirists like David Sedaris and Augustine, like, people are sort of starting to pin them down a little bit and saying, you know, even memoirists can't, you know, take these liberties anymore. You know, so it's like the whole sort of, I think there's been, like, this, so there's been this long shift over, like, 20 years where we've sort of been forced to become more and more accurate for a number of reasons. One, the internet's made us more accurate. Two, there's, like, this sort of purple penciling that the internet makes possible where any mistake you made will immediately be sort of highlighted. And so it makes everyone sort of more hidebound and more cautious. I would say that one of the results is magazine writing today is certainly much less interesting than it was sort of 20 years ago or 30 years ago. You just don't have the big, sweeping, ambitious narratives that you used to have. And if you go back and look at the stories that everyone says were, like, the great magazine articles of all time, if you look at, like, Frank Sinatra Has a Cold by Gay Talese, or, like, the Pump House Gang by Tom Wolfe, or, you know, or that Joan Didion piece about the governor in Sacramento, like, all that stuff is before the internet. And I believe that the methods they used to sort of create those stories maybe wouldn't even be kosher today, you know, because everyone is being so much more cautious and so much more careful, and you can't do some of the sort of creative scene setting that writers were able to do back in the day and that people don't do anymore. So I think what we've seen is we've seen sort of a kind of Baudelaireizing of journalism and particular magazine writing. Again, I'm not talking about daily journalism. I think daily journalism serves, and I think like what the New York Times does or what AFP does, that serves a different role because they do have a monitoring function. And to be credible in terms of if you're gonna be bringing to light a government scandal, it's important that you have 100% credibility in other areas. Otherwise, that argument doesn't work. I'm not someone who ever is bringing to light any government scandals or anything, or you know, not intentionally. And so so what's happened is that, you know, we've had this gradual diminishing in some ways of the ambition of stories, at least in terms of a narrative and emotional sense. I think they've become more accurate, but I do believe that we've lost something. Now, for me personally, and this is where it ties into sort of what the talk is today, I realize that if I want to tell the kind of stories that I sort of became a writer to tell, if I wanted to tell sort of these big kind of personal stories and narrative stories and try to kind of talk about, you know, more like sort of the, you know, the full complexity of human emotion, I really only could do that through fiction qua fiction, because I wasn't going to be able to get away with doing it in as a journalist anymore in the same way. So I have continued as a magazine writer for years and years and years. And as I said, I have to admit, I don't think I'm nearly as interesting a magazine writer as I was for sort of all those years. But I have sort of creatively found another outlet, and that outlet is as a, you know, is writing short stories and writing novels. And that's something that sort of I had to adapt myself to almost in order to survive. And so that's sort of how, that's what kind of brings me, what brought me to this topic, was that I had to find a way to continue to tell stories in a world where the nature of what was permissible as a nonfiction writer or a memoirist, I felt, had kind of changed. And that's sort of where we are today. And sort of as a little example, are we okay with time? We're fine? Okay. I was going to read two things, I thought. I'm going to read a nonfiction piece. Well, here's what happened. My youngest daughter Lola, who at the time was like six, she had become a very avid gymnast, and we were sort of having to drive around. You know, every sort of Saturday morning, we'd have to get up early and drive her to these gymnastic meets around New York, and it was kind of this peek into this culture of sort of sports families, kind of like the equivalent of hockey moms, only with gymnasts. So I was asked by a magazine, an American magazine called Men's Health, to write about genetic testing of people for certain genes that indicate a disposition towards being a good athlete, right? So I wrote this piece about that, and then I'll read a little bit of a fictional piece that I wrote, kind of a short story that I wrote, which was sort of based on the same experience. We tell ourselves, this is the nonfiction, we tell ourselves we are doing this for our children. The early mornings, the cold walk to the costly rental car, the long drive through pre-dawn murk to distant suburb where we wait, huddled against glass doors to a not yet set up for competition gymnasium, parents bundled in parkas and hoods, daughters wearing down coats and sweats over sparkly leotards while their mothers do a last minute hair touch-up, securing bow, sprinkling pixie dust, and applying eyeliner. The six-year-olds, in dawn's first light, with faces bright with artificial blush and lip gloss, stand with their teammates, the girls from NYC Elite here, the girls from Long Island Athletic Club there, the parents yawning, sipping coffee, freezing, checking their watches and wondering when this damn gym is going to open. It had become a dreaded ritual in our family. The pre-dawn patrol Saturday, the loading of girls into car, and then the long drive and the inevitable argument and dispute about which turn off and exit while the kids slept in the back. I would wonder, how did an innocent 3-hour-a-week after-school activity evolve into a team membership, many thousands in annual fees, more spent on private training, and another a couple hundred on leotards and uniforms and sweats, and don't forget the competition fees, and oh yeah, my favorite, the $20 they charge you as the parent to go and watch your precious little flower in this competition. When did a little healthy fun turn into a grueling parental obligation, every bit as ghastly in its early rising and road tripping as being a hockey mom? The same planning, mapping, spending, cheering, and ultimately for what, I began to wonder. So little Lola can be judged? And oh no, she only got an 8.2 on Beam? And take home a participant trophy? Why, my wife and I began to wonder, are we doing this? So that's the that's sort of the beginning of the nonfiction piece I wrote about the gymnastics experience. And then for a short story I wrote, I used that experience, a version of it, to think about a gymnast in China. Like any mother, I was initially pleased by Kwan's development. A baby stands for the first time. We applaud. We are proud. Kwan, of course, was upright very early. At 5 months, she was balanced on sturdy legs, holding the edge of a chair. A month later, she was walking. That was when I began to worry. I recalled my mother's descriptions of my own infancy. I, too, had crawled, walked, and run precociously. We are gifted women. My own talents had been both a burden and a curse. At 2.5, I could do a cartwheel and swing with alternating hands from bar to bar on the playground apparatus. Other mothers would praise my own mother for her good luck. My athletic prowess almost made up for the fact that I was born female. At 3, I could do a backbend kickover, sideways vault, and 4 consecutive forward rolls. I was introduced to the parallel bars, the beam, the mat, and the vault that year, joining a class of girls 3 years older than me. Within a month, I was the best in our gym. I won my first regional meet when I was 4. My prize, a bouquet of peonies, some chalk, and a coupon from a state bookstore. Our neighborhood work unit newsletter came and wrote a story about me, quoting my mother as saying, "In today's China, a girl can dream to become anything she wants," which didn't sound like my mother at all. I don't remember when the visit started, the short, stout men in Western-style clothes who would come and sit down with my mother, ostensibly to talk about me, but actually appraising her, asking how tall my father and grandmother were, trying to predict from this data my eventual height. They would leave us with vouchers that we could exchange at state stores for extra kilograms of pork and chicken. These men would also show up at the gym. We practiced in the out-of-bounds area of a basketball court, the space jammed with mats and equipment. We used to move each apparatus into place when we switched routines, the instructors lining us up and urging us all to push at the same time, little girls straining against the old wooden and iron pommel and bars. After I won another meet, I was allowed to sit out these little press gangs, the first, clearest indication to me that I was different. And I would perch on a chair where I would retape my hands and ankles for the next exercise. I would find out later that these men who visited us, all of them short, had been gymnasts themselves, Olympians even. They scoured the province for promising athletes. I was at the very top of this list. What pleased all of them was my combination of athletic ability and discipline. For a 5-year-old, I was poised and hardworking, and I believe it is true that we like what we are good at. And so I took to the schedule of leaving school after lunch and riding the bus across the city to the new gym, where I would have private instruction for 2 hours before the rest of the girls arrived. I was promoted so that I was competing against girls 5 years older than me and still winning most of my events. I had been given more perfect tens than any girl in the history of our city. On the day I achieved this distinction, my mother was given a coupon that entitled us each to a new winter coat from the springtime department store. I chose a violet parka filled with synthetic feathers. Later, I would wonder what my mother thought of all this, of why she allowed a very small girl to spend 6 hours a day doing gymnastics, of how the stress of competition and the pressure to excel would affect a 5-year-old. Perhaps if my father had been alive, she would have had the confidence to ask more questions. But as it was, she was grateful for the perks that accompanied my success, and I never complained. That would come later. I remember how disappointed everyone was when I had a growth spurt. They urged my mother to feed me less, to deny me the roast pork and sticky rice that I loved. I was to eat millet and summer spinach. All of us girls were urged to eat a sour combination of tea leaves, mustard greens, and radish that I later found out was intended as a laxative so we would purge our meals as quickly as possible, gaining vital nutrients but not centimeters. We were to stay tiny. At that point, because I was competing against girls so much older than me, I didn't notice that I was growing so quickly. Remember, these girls were all diminutive, rows of leotard-wearing dolls with their hair pulled back into tight buns, their arms and legs as thin as celery stalks. But we were measured weekly. Our height and weight and the size and radius of our hips, shoulders, arms, legs, and feet all carefully noted. "Ah, Zhao, how much fat did you eat this week?" the instructor would say as she slid the weights down the scale. "You will break the beam." I think my mother felt for me then, as she would ladle tiny portions of pork and rice into my bowl, and I would be so hungry after 6 hours at the gym, after 100 perfect dismounts and another 100 level fives, I would try to eat my food slowly, but it was impossible. "Chew," my mother would urge, but I gobbled it down. We moved to a larger apartment in a new Donway, my mother securing a better work unit in the headquarters office of a local truck company. We had a real kitchen with a two-burner stove, a small refrigerator, and our own television. A few other gymnasts from the Dongfeng Motor Works Athletic Club also lived in this building, and it was understood that we were all competing against each other but could not say this to one another. I was the youngest and already the most accomplished, and I took some pride in this. Refusing to even acknowledge the girls I knew had already aged out of any chance of a call-up to junior nationals, I was careful to be polite to those girls who I saw as rivals. My mother and I studied my competition and knew each of their weaknesses. This girl was bad on floor, that one was unsteady on beam. None of them were any threat to me all around, though there were a few who were strong in specific exercises. That advantage, I knew, would erode with age. Girls became better on bar, for example, as they grow older and develop more upper arm strength. So I knew that while one or two girls might be a little better at one or two events, none of them were 3 years better than me. Older girls, even as old as 14, were still in the Donway, even though they no longer were competing for the athletic club. These families would be asked to leave so the new promising girls could move in and join the team. I watched these families go, plastic suitcases stuffed with clothes and wrapped with elastic belts. I knew my mother watched them and shuddered. She did not want to leave. It was winter when I was called up to junior nationals. It wasn't the men in suits who came to tell me. It was my mother, who rushed to the gym in her new leather and rabbit fur coat. I was practicing a forward kickover to salto to dismount from the beam, a complicated move that my coach was making me execute as a sequence at full extension to focus my mind. It was grueling, and if I slipped, I fell awkwardly, so that it was hard to break my fall, and I took the full impact on my ankles and feet. After 20 minutes, I was sore. I took a break to chalk my hands, and that's when I saw my mother, beaming, her face pink inside the fur lining of her hood. It was so cold in the gym, I could see her breath as she waved to me to come over. I looked at Coach to see if it was all right, and he nodded. "You've been promoted," she said. At first, I was confused, thinking that I had been elevated to yet another higher age group, which didn't make sense because I was already competing against girls 6 years older than me, and the next higher age group was actually a step down because it was understood that these girls, already with breasts and hips at 15, were washed up. Junior nationals. She was so proud of me. She put her hand on my cheek and held it there. "Zhao," I heard my coach shouting. I ran back to practice and tried not to think about what my mother had said. For the next 5 years, I would see my mother for a total of 18 days. So this was sort of two versions of the same experience, which was watching my daughter go through this like intense gymnastics thing she was doing with her team. One was like one was sort of this nonfiction version of events, which to me wasn't nearly as satisfying as trying to do it and tell the story as a story of what the girl goes through. But as I felt like for me to sort of deal with the emotions of what it's like to try to conform as an athlete to this kind of standard, I felt like, well, it's better for me to do it as a short story, to do it fictionally rather than to do it non-fictionally. So the sort of takeaway from this, or what I'm interested in, is this idea that as a writer, we have to find a way to kind of express ourselves. And if if one path is kind of closed off, and I felt like the memoir and nonfiction path sort of became more fraught and more difficult because the standards had sort of changed, and the stuff that like people used to do, like you know, Kapuscinski or Bruce Chatwin or Paul Thoreau, a lot of this stuff, it like, you know, I think it was held to a different standard than a lot of nonfiction writing is today. And I think if you want to sort of write with that kind of freedom and that kind of sort of emotional ambition, I don't think you can necessarily do that anymore in journalism or nonfiction. And I think that sort of has kind of forced me or forces a writer to sort of just come out and say, well, what I'm writing now is just fiction. It's not nonfiction. And unfortunately, I think for people like me, because I still do a lot of journalism, it's kind of made, I feel like I haven't really written a great magazine article, you know, in like 10 years, in part because I'm using that most creative part of me to write in another medium. You know, and I guess coincidentally, when I kind of, the last time I was in Tokyo and went back to that, to that bookstore, the Aoyama Book Center, like the magazine section it was no longer even in the front of the store. It had been moved to the back of the store, and it was sort of 8 feet wide, you know. So even as my ambitions as a magazine writer have sort of diminished, I think like it seems like the magazines themselves have sort of diminished and kind of almost vanished. So that's sort of the larger idea that I feel like. Writers are seldom willing to discuss sort of what liberties they've taken with the truth and where they may have, you know, played a little fast and loose with the rules in terms of storytelling. And one of the things that I kind of felt would be useful or helpful would be if I just kind of talked about that as an idea and introduced it as an idea, because I think that it's something that people are like ashamed of, or people feel vulnerable, or people feel threatened, so they don't want to kind of admit that they haven't always been entirely, you know, 100% kosher. So I'm sort of the first to admit that, like, yeah, that I have sinned, and part of my atonement for that was realizing that I can't really do that anymore, and I'm now writing, and that's why I sort of decided, well, I'm going to write a fiction to do my creative thing, and my journalism will be a little bit less interesting.
So we've got about 15 minutes left. So I'll throw the floor open to questions. Please identify yourselves. We've got a microphone open. Yes,
Jim. Hi. I'm wondering if some of the changes also age. I mean, could you? The interesting stories that you were writing when you were 25 hanging out in Japan, could you have those same kind of experiences now? And is it just maybe the kind of things you're doing are less interesting to write about?
I think that's probably right. I think that I think it's a combination of age and then the type of stories that one starts to do are a little bit less ambitious. But I think it's also that kind of subculture story, it's just not really done anymore in magazines. And so for me, it's done more like, pretty much now, anytime an interesting subculture emerges in the world, it's pretty much like a reality show before you've ever even, you know, seen it. So part of it is, yeah, I think part of it's maturity. And also being mature enough to realize if I kept doing what I was doing, I probably would get in trouble and get fired, right? So if I'm going to work at Time Magazine, I have to play by the rules there. If I'm going to write, you know, if I'm going to write for Bloomberg Business Week, I have to play by the rules. So it's also maturity and realizing, like, I have to play by the rules, otherwise I'm going to get in trouble. Because people began to get in trouble. I mean, that's what happened, is you began to see people getting in trouble for stuff that, like, 20 years ago, I mean, there were stories published in magazines, you know, where they didn't even say whether it was fiction or nonfiction. It was just sort of published as a story, and you kind of were left to figure out, you know, what it was. The William Volman story, More Benadryl Wine the Journalist, which is a great, great story. It was published in Esquire, and I mean, it's a story about, you know, it's a very typical Volman story. He goes back to Bangkok with a photographer, and they go to Cambodia, and they're supposedly on the track of the Khmer Rouge, but it's really about the dissipation that happens to the two of them on this journey. And I read it, and then I didn't know what it was. And I eventually asked Terry McDonald, who had been the editor of Esquire at the time, like, what did you publish that as, fiction or nonfiction? And he just said, well, neither. You know, and I think that category is and that used to be like a category. And I think that's where, like, Kapuscinski, a writer like Kapuscinski lived in that category. I mean, was he writing fiction or was he writing nonfiction? Well, it was neither, right? But there was sort of an emotional truth about the, you know, about Ethiopia or about Iran that he seemed to be expressing with this in-between medium. And I think that that sort of nuance and that sort of gray area is vanishing to some extent. And part of it is, as we were talking about before, that James Frey Million Little Pieces thing, which was like a big, you know, cause célèbre and all this. This was a book that was pretty self-evidently fiction if you read the book. It was hard to read that book and not realizing that he was living in this weird, you know, half-fictional zone the whole time. And the voice of the book was... But he got in trouble for that, and then all these memoirists began getting in trouble, and that just kind of confirmed to me, well, I can't, you know, I'm not as successful as any of these people, and if they're getting in trouble, I you know, I'm going to have to play I'm going to have to be a lot more cautious. And so it's age in the sense, like, yeah, I'm not doing the same kind of stories, but it's also age in the sense, like, I'm more mature, and I got to, you know, I have to make a living here, so I'm going to be a little more careful, too. We accept that. We accept that a movie can say based on a true story before it, and you know it's like the entire thing can be made up. We just accept that because it's officially like an entertainment medium. I don't know. I mean, what documentaries get away with is astonishing. I mean, if you've ever gone, and I've done this, I've done a magazine article following up, like doing a story that a documentary had aired about, and when you realize that, like, you know, the people that they presented in one, you know, one light weren't, you know, they weren't, it wasn't even the pilot, you know, or something like, even, you know, sort of this weird stuff that you start to find, and we accept that in one medium, but for some reason, in this era, we're like, there's like a very zealous patrolling of journalism that's going on, and I think it's made everyone sort of, a lot more cautious, maybe to the detriment overall of, like, what was kind of fun and entertaining about, you know, reading.
I kind of have two questions, but I'll ask the first one first. Earlier, before we started, you're having a discussion with Alison and myself about the fact that you felt the internet has actually made you worse as a writer. Can you want to expand on that for everyone else's sake?
Well, I think that's what I was talking about. I think I became I feel on some level that anything that makes you more cautious as a writer makes you like a worse writer. Because if while you're writing something, you're sitting here thinking like, oh man, I might get in trouble for this, or you know, I'm gonna have these people all mad at me because of this, or there's this other version of events out there that contradicts what I think, you know, what I think I'm saying or what I want to say, and so you're not as aggressive, you're not attacking in quite the same way, and I think that you know, that's right there to the detriment of the story, you know. I think that anything that makes you more cautious in terms of trying to tell a story, it can, you know, can, because the critical process is coming in too early, right? I mean, you can't start, you can't sort of, you know, write, look at every sentence and then try to look at it through defensively. It's just going to make for a worse story.
You had a second question, you said.
Well, my second question is, I'm sort of reacting to the two excerpts that you read. And the first one made me feel glad that I chose not to have kids. the second one made me feel like I understand where you're coming from in terms of wanting to write more fiction, because you can be more expansive, not just emotionally, but verbally, you know, and linguistically. Because as a magazine writer, too, I can tell you that lately I've noticed that I've been asked to write more like 1,500-word pieces rather than 3,000-word pieces, and everything's getting smaller and smaller. Mm-hmm. And I'm asking myself, I mean, people have a short attention span now or something, like they don't want to read long features anymore. Is that my fault? You know, it's almost like I'm trying to say, like, I'm being forced to become more boring too, you know? So, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. I mean, I think that's sort of the, I mean, one of the prices you pay, I think when I was younger, almost every story I did was like an idea I came up with, right? And I would think of something and then sell it to an editor and then go do it. And now I feel like every single thing I did is something that an editor tells me to go do, because they want it, and that's the path of least resistance to me too, because I know if I just do it, they need it, it goes in the magazine, there's no trouble, no hassle along the way, you know. But what that means is that I'm not doing anything as interesting, because almost every idea an editor has is just like basically saying the name of a famous person, and then I have to call them and see if they're available, if they'll do it or not. I mean, that's like, most ideas are like, you know, Jeff Bezos. And then you, will he sit down with you or not? And that's pretty much the extent, you know. So part of it is that I think I became less ambitious in terms of you know, I'm not as aggressively proposing stories, in part because I became more cautious, because I realized the methods I was using to tell my stories probably weren't 100% kosher by the standards, you know, of the world. Again, it's not like anyone ever explained to me what the rules were. You know, I mean, really, it's amazing how long I could go for years and years as a writer, and no one just telling me, you know, you can't do this or you can't do that, because anytime I thought I understood it, somebody, you know, it would change a little, or it shifted a little, and it has shifted. Over like the last 20 years, it has shifted, but no one's kind of saying how it shifted, you know, and that's kind of what's confusing to me, is how are we all supposed to know this? Am I really dumb and slow and not getting it, or is it just changing and everyone just kind of feels what they're supposed to do now or not? But like I said, in the 90s, I was doing I had an editor at a women's magazine just add a character into a story of mine that I don't think she existed, right? And it was sort of this example of this trend that the story was about, right? And this person showed up in my story, and I was like, oh. You know, and so my takeaway from that was, well, look, I mean, you can do that too, you know, or what? I don't know. I mean, so every editor, every publication, everyone has a different standard. And what I began to do is I just said, look, yeah, I have to be able to adapt to the standard of whoever I'm working for. You know, if I'm working for Time, if I'm working for Sports Illustrated, if I'm working for GQ, whatever, I have to understand what the rules of this particular publication are. And then you become smart enough and kind of figure that out.
Hi.
Hello. You may think that you're achieving a higher truth by what you're doing and by capturing it the way you're... But does it ever jar you to think that you were just writing, you know, bullshit and passing that off as truth, and that therefore you are actually kind of betraying the reader and actually undermining the tenets by which people... do read, even if it was quite entertaining? And I realize in movies this shit happens all the time.
No, I think you're right, and I think that's a legitimate question, and I think I do ask myself that, and I do wonder about that. I think I have a pretty good internal sort of measure about about trying to stay sort of close to what the actual truth was, or the emotional truth of it, or what the real larger story of it was, and some of the sacrifices made in terms of trying to make that storytelling more efficient, I don't think necessarily we're betraying the reader. But your point is totally valid, and I have to cop to that, and that's one of the reasons. Again, that's another reason why I think I made this evolution, which was to acknowledge that I can't keep doing things the way I was doing them, because of that. I mean, I think that's a legitimate point.
I think your comment was the market won't accept it. It wasn't that actually felt differently about it, right?
Well,
which may actually say really great things about the market. You know, a higher standard is stunning to me. But maybe
I would buy that. But I think the market not accepting something and coincided with. You know, as Kime was saying, like, I became an older, somewhat more mature person and looked at the world maybe a little bit differently. But I also sort of figured out that I had to change and my methods had to change. So whatever reasons you can point to as being the catalyst of that, I think that there was an awakening around that issue. And it can happen for a number of reasons. I don't necessarily, but see, this is what I would ask you though. Maybe the market has changed and shifted. I don't think it entirely has, but I think it has changed. But is that serving the reader better than the market served the reader before? I mean, I would ask you that. Is the consumer of journalism better served today than the consumer of journalism was, you know, 20 years ago? I mean, what do you think? I don't know. Is it equal? Is it better or worse? I mean, we don't know. So maybe the market standard have changed, but is the quality and level of information actually better or worse?
We've got 2 minutes, so we've got time for one last quick question. Sit up.
It seems to me American journalism has got a much higher sense of professionalism, both in the way that people treat journalists in the States, the regard in which the profession is held, and most American organizations seem to be incredibly heavy in layers of management, fact-checking. I mean, I know at time people complain that the fact-checking process is just painful and very, very time-consuming. How do you see that developed from what you described as 20
years
ago?
England was always pretty loosey-goosey about, I mean, you know, in terms of what, at least in their mag, I never wrote for, I think I wrote for the Times, the London Times Sunday magazine once or something, and that was also, they didn't really have fact-checkers or anything. But, I mean, I think that there's an agreement or implicit understanding between the reader of a source and what the journalistic sort of standards of that source are, and I think consciously or subconsciously the reader knows, well, if I'm reading this, it's a, take it with a grain of salt kind of thing, and if I'm reading The Economist or Bloomberg, whatever, it's held to a different standard. I think it's I think the reader does know along those lines, and I think the English reader is just accustomed to a bit more kind of latitude in terms of what they're, you know, what they're reading. At the same time, England has libel laws that are much tougher than the U.S. I mean, that's the interesting thing about England, is I think that it's policed to some extent, that the journalists there are policed by the fact that they do run more legal risk if they really screw something up, because if I'm not mistaken, in England you don't have to prove intent, right? You can lose a libel case even without intent, right? So that holds you to a different standard than in the U.S. So possibly they can have a different approach. Well, for one thing, there's an economic reason why you don't have fact checkers. I mean, it's a lot cheaper to do a magazine if you don't have fact checkers. But there's also I think there's also a legal, there's a caution that's naturally there because of that legal system.
Okay, well, thank you. Round of applause for our speaker. Very interesting. These are some interesting questions about our profession.
Oh, yeah.
And there's a souvenir from the FCC.
Thank you.
I'm not sure what it is, actually. Well, it's a happy shot. Anyway, thank you.
Did you ever tap anyone's phone?
I would if I could. I know, and they, but that's illegal, right? I mean, that's like that standard you kind of know.
I just noticed I used to read Rolling Stone in the early 70s. You know, when you were interested. I mean, you had 20,000 words.
Yeah.
About Ralph Steady. That does not exist anymore.
No.
Did you read any of that stuff?
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you.